Test 1, 2. Test 1, 2. Test. All right. Hopefully some more people trickle in, but I think we're going to go ahead and get started. So good morning, everybody. Welcome to Data Science and Security, for Security and Forensics, tutorial number 5. And before we get into the actual kind of the meat of things, I kind of want to cover some administrative items. Martin, if you could just verify that you can hear me on the stream, that'd be great. So I got some reference group feedback regarding some items regarding the course, and I'm not going to go over everything here. And so some things were being asked about is like how I evaluate the homework, because it's 40% of your grade, and then also in the future, maybe I can try to provide you with more resources for machine learning resources for Python or C++ and similar kind of libraries. But now I'm going to go over how I actually evaluate the homework. So there were kind of a lot of questions regarding it. And one question was like, do we need to pass every single individual assignment in order to pass all the assignments? And the answer is, I mean, I don't suggest you do this, but no, you do not need to pass all 4 assignments to get a passing grade for the assignments. So technically, you could fail one assignment one and get good grades on the rest of the assignments, and you'll still pass. You get a single letter grade for the assignments overall, and each assignment is essentially weighed as a 1/4 of the grade. And they asked me, okay, how do I go about grading the assignments? Am I just grading it assignment 1, assignment 2, assignment 3, assignment 4? Generally speaking, yes. So you submit the assignment before the submission date, and I typically go through assignment 1 through 4 in order. However, I take notes regarding each of the assignments, and I may come back to various assignments if I think, okay, maybe this grade will go up or down, or just based on the general kind of curve of the grading, I say, okay, maybe I was too harsh on these earlier assignments, and I'll go and revisit them. So each assignment, kind of getting more into the details of it, is 10 points. And every assignment is, you'll notice every assignment is split into 2 parts. And there are 5 points that are reserved for the first part and 5 points that are reserved for the second part. So on the first part, the maximum amount of points you can get is 5, and the maximum amount of points you can get on the second part is 5. They're kind of independent of each other. That's how I grade these assignments. So first what I do is I go through each of the assignments, and I try to sum up as quantitatively as possible the points earned on every assignment that you turn in. So this generates a letter grade based on some points, and this is just kind of the initial step. So NTNU has a grading scale where they say, okay, if you get 89% and above, this is an A. 77% to 88%, this is a B. And these also correspond with different kind of more qualitative ratings of the grades. Is this homework excellent? Is this homework very good? So on and so forth. So, I mean, this is just like a cutout of my grade book from last year. And as you can see here, maybe I'll shift it a little. And you can see I've blobbed out the candidate names. I'll go through the grading progress. I have a grading progress kind of area where if I'm satisfied with the grading at the time, I say it's done. Although otherwise I may make a note, especially if it's a borderline grade. So if your grade is falling in between, say, a B and a C or a D and E, I make a note of that because those are the difficult decisions I have to make. Kind of depending on your homework, do I bump you up or do I bump you down, essentially? So then you can see here, there's a total score here. And then there's the score for the, say, particular homework. And then there's a score for the, I call it the writing section. This is usually the first section, which is more theoretical. And then there's the program section, which is usually more practical. As you can see, the maximum amount of point you can get in each part is 5 points. And essentially, this is where I also make my comments and feedback on your assignments as well. And generally, the way I go about grading is, I kind of look at what you did, and if you did it as I asked, you kind of get full credit, and it's not totally wrong. If maybe there are things missing, then I start to deduct points from 5. So I usually start with 5, then I go minus 1.5 for this, or minus 1.5 for that, something like this. Yeah, and then at times too, I mean, I've had cases where maybe a student, the points were saying a C, but they did a portion of the homework exceptionally well. For instance, one time someone did this implementation of a neural network that was really beyond what I was asking. And I said, okay, this is excellent. Even though the points are saying slightly below a B, I'll bump it up to a B, for instance. I have a rubric of expectations and point distributions for each assignment. So, for example, this is for assignment 1 from 2022 last year. And here you can see basically for each question I'm asking you, there's some given amount of points, which you can get a maximum amount of points for. And it's not always kind of equally distributed, as you can see here, but sometimes it is. And you can see for each section, kind of section 1, section 2, they sum up to 5 points, right? Just as a note, typically speaking, if a question has sub-questions, these might be weighed less. And oftentimes, programming questions are weighed a little bit more. Just some grading tips. Basically, if you at least attempt the assignment, and you are doing what it tells you to do, and it's obviously not bullshit that you're writing, then you're pretty much guaranteed to pass. The worst thing you can do is just not attempt something or not turn in the assignment. That's the worst thing you can do, is just not turn in the assignment. I've also gotten questions in the past regarding, like, how long should analytical answers be for the homework. And usually people want like a page number, but generally speaking with the assignments, I'd rather you be as concise as possible rather than writing too much. So basically, as long as you try to answer the question and you provide a reasoning where I or like anybody else can be kind of convinced of your reasoning, then you will probably get full credit. So deductions for kind of credit would be providing insufficient reasoning or having some results or some answers that are wrong, quite off the mark. For answers that require analysis, usually in my rubric I have several right answers that I'm expecting you to answer the question as. And generally speaking, this is just kind of a rough estimate, but you should refer to at least like two-thirds of them. So we should be kind of thinking in a parallel sort of way. So sometimes you can still have answers I did not explicitly think of, and you'll still get full credit. So this is also an option. Then this is just a distribution of last year's homework grades. So, as you can see, the majority of people got Bs. I think it's relatively easier to get a B or a C in the course. Generally, when you're going down and looking at the D's, E's, and F's, this is when people were not submitting assignments or not attempting certain portions of the assignments or cases of, like, plagiarism for the F's. So, any questions regarding grading or how I grade the assignments? No? Okay. There's also a question regarding assignment feedback. So as you know, kind of all the assignments are turned in at the same time, and they're also graded during the same period as well. So, like, officially, there's no good way of getting feedback on the earlier assignments, at least as of now. So next year's, I may try to stagger the submissions or do something more official. But for now, if you want feedback on any of your assignments, you can feel free to send me an email where you can ask for feedback, and I can do a kind of a review of the assignments and point out what is good or bad, needs improvement, or going in the wrong direction. I'm not going to do like a full grading of the assignment, because then that's like double work for me. Yeah, and then I've also, it's been suggested to me too that you can also ask each other about kind of the quality of your assignments. If you're interested in doing that, I've not thought to make it like an official way of kind of quality control, but it's an option. Yeah, so any other questions regarding kind of these grading administrative items, homework? Good for now. If you have more questions, just ask or email me anytime. Okay, but on to today's theme. It's more or less a methodological zoo, I would say. And if you looked at the book chapters, it's split into two different areas, these methods of symbolic learning and these methods of statistical learning, right? So symbolic learning, the book doesn't give a great definition, but it essentially says you're representing knowledge or generated knowledge in a symbolic way. So using rules or trees, these sort of items. So examples of these things are decision trees and regression trees, association rule mining, or the a priori algorithm, as well as the naive Bayes classifier. And generally speaking, these rules are maybe a little bit more interpretable than, say, symbolic learning is a little bit more interpretable and easy to understand than statistical learning, where it gets a little bit more abstract. Statistical learning, it's kind of a broad array of algorithms, and I don't think it's the end-all, be-all kind of definition of this categorization of algorithms that the book does. But looking at the stuff that we are looking at here, generally it involves an objective function defined by some weights, where we're trying to optimize this function, that is, update the model to fit it to our training data, where the errors kind of guide the optimization. So typically the model is some sort of function with learned weights. The exception to this rule is the k-nearest neighbors algorithm, which we're going to talk about a little bit. Then we're going to discuss what are called discriminative methods. These are kind of somewhat similar algorithms regarding linear regression, logistic regression, and then support vector machines, which we're going to get to later in tutorial 6 and lecture 6. And then also today we're going to discuss the kind of the beginnings and the starts, introduction to artificial neural networks. So unfortunately, I didn't get to send out the questions for this tutorial as early as I would have liked to. I had to go to a seminar last week and it really kept me busy. But we can still, if you have an idea of how to answer the question, feel free to respond to the questions. Basically, what we're asking here, starting off with symbolic learning, is what is a decision tree? Does anybody want to take a stab at it? And what are the different types of decision trees? Can a decision tree handle categorical data? I think I saw someone nod yes. Can it handle numeric data? Yeah, it can. And I think you may be aware of this by now, but this is kind of a leading question. Can a decision tree be used for the purposes of regression? And if you look in the book, yes, it can. So let's go ahead and kind of discuss what is a decision tree. Usually it's a prediction and classification model. Of course, you can use it for regression as well. That represents internal nodes as attributes, where the branches from the attributes are regarding some sort of split on the data with respect to the value of the attributes. And the leaves, that being the terminal nodes of the tree, are the classes or the prediction. So this is a common example that you find online for categorical data, or nominal features here. Basically, you have some table of different features, whether it's sun, what is the outlook? Is it sunny or overcast? Is it humid or is it not? Is there a strong wind or is there a weak wind? And more or less the prediction or kind of category that we're trying to classify is, should we go surfing or not? And from this table, you can build the following decision tree. So this decision tree, I believe, is maybe overfit on our given data, but that's okay for the sake of the example. So basically, you start with the outlook, and you say, okay, and assume that this the sample we're going to say is not in our current data set. So, okay, the outlook. Assume that the outlook is sunny and it is humid, then we would make a prediction that, no, we will not go surfing, right? And likewise, this corresponds to the entries in the table here for each of the samples. So if the outlook is rainy, we go down this branch. Then if the humidity is, well, we're not going to take into account humidity here. If the wind is strong, then no, we're not going to go surfing, right? Pretty straightforward with respect to how these decision trees work. So as mentioned before, these decision trees can work with both categorical and nominal attributes and numerical attributes. So when the nodes are basically categorical, usually you can do a split from the node here based on every single possible value that the feature can take. For example, outlook can be sunny, overcast, or rainy. Decision trees with numeric or continuous attributes, it's a little bit more tricky. Generally, you're using a binary decision tree in this case. So from every node, you only have two possible branches coming out of that node. And basically, this node will contain a rule. So it says, like, everything that is, for the feature X, everything less than 7 goes to the left, and everything greater than or equal to 7 goes to the right. Yeah? So the trees can handle both numerical and categorical attributes, and you can use it for classification and regression. So here's a case where we have features which are numeric, and we're also doing, it's also a regression tree. So you can see that there's actual numbers at the bottom of the tree. And more or less, it's the same thing we've seen before. So for instance, you can see how this tree here corresponds to with how the data has been split up over here. So basically everything for X2, where everything is less than 0.03, we're kind of making this split right here. We follow down the branch. We say, okay, if something is greater than X1 at 0.8, then it gets this following prediction, right? And then as you've seen in the book, with regression trees, you can, for the leaf node, you don't just need to, you can not only have like an actual number, but you can have some sort of arbitrary function or a linear function. So this makes it a little bit more dynamic. Okay, so how do we go about creating a decision tree? There are kind of two simple algorithms that guide the creation of decision trees, the first of which is for creating categorical decision trees, and this is using this ID3 algorithm. So essentially what you do is you create a root node where the attribute for the node being chosen here is actually the best attribute of your data set. And this is selected using something like information gain or the Gini index, like we saw from the previous week. Then, as I was saying, there's kind of this branch coming out from this node here, taking on each of the values that this feature can take. And what you're doing is kind of in the next, so in this initial node, imagine you have all of your samples. And when you follow down one path with a value of a feature, you are creating a subset of samples in the next node where all those samples are taking on this particular value of this attribute. So all the samples here, sunny. All the samples here are overcast. All the samples here are rainy. So this is how we partition the training data set into these subsets based on these values of this root node attribute. Basically, you repeat this process recursively on each subset of the data. So here, basically, from this set of data here, you're then looking, say, of this subset of data, ignoring, say, this feature for now, what is the best feature? And you'd say, okay, humidity looks like the best feature. And again, we have each branch for the attribute value that humidity can take. And at the bottom here of these leaf nodes, we partition the data where each sample here is required to have this feature value. So here, the sample has a high humidity. Here, the samples have normal humidity, right? And basically, you do this until the terminal case, where there's just a single class in the node. This is what generates the actual leaf and prediction of your decision tree. So you have an impurity of zero, like you have an entropy of zero, right? It's a totally homogeneous set of samples. So does this make sense on how to generate a categorical decision tree? At least maybe kind of theoretically. There's algorithms in the book you can look at more explicitly. Yeah? Not too bad. All right. So, what are some issues that can come up here? Given that the leaf nodes of our classifier are totally homogeneous, why might that be a problem? So basically, this is creating an overfitted classifier, right? You have a kind of a perfect performance on your training data set, but it does not necessarily extend to the testing data set or any external data sets. So you have some possible solutions that involve pruning, that is cutting branches or leaves from your tree, right? So there's this pre-pruning approach where you're limiting the depth of your tree upon the creation of the tree. And then there's these post-pruning approaches where, say, some branches or subtrees are just replaced with leaves that are not perceived to assist too much in the classification. So say, trying to remove some redundant branches and whatnot. Okay, so that was the categorical case. Now on to, I think, what people find to be the more interesting case, at least I do, creating a decision tree dealing with numeric features. And it's actually very similar to the ID3 algorithm, and it was mentioned in the lecture, this C4.5 algorithm. It's very similar. Essentially, what we're doing is we create a root node, where again, the attribute is determined to be the best feature of our data set. And what this means is that it best splits the data between classes. So this can be evaluated using the information gain or Gini index. So this actually requires a couple of additional steps. So for instance, it also requires discovering for each feature, where is the best point to split upon that feature? Which point of the feature splits your data set into the most homogeneous subsets of data samples. Then also you have to figure out, okay, yes, we have the best split maybe for each feature, but which feature overall is getting the best split? Again, rather than branches showing all the possible different values that an attribute can take, we're working with binary trees. So one branch considers if the data is less than or equal to this splitting point, and the other branch considers if the data is, say, greater than or equal to that point, the sample's attribute, I should say. And like the kind of ID3 case, this process is repeated recursively on all nodes until the base cases are met. That is that the subsets at the bottom, your leaves, are pure, they're homogeneous. Okay, so this is just kind of a quick, what'd I do? Decided to go to sleep on me. Come back. Okay, here we are. So this is kind of a visual example of how decision trees are made. And these are 100 samples, the last 100 samples of the Iris dataset, where we're only considering two attributes so that we can actually visualize the data. And we're only considering two classes. So right now there's the green class and there's the blue class. Yeah. And if you just look at this dataset here, is the X feature or Y feature better for splitting the data? Just taking a look. If you were to draw a straight line down one of these features, the horizontal feature or the vertical feature better for splitting the data into green and blue? Yeah, so making this kind of, so the horizontal feature, right? And this horizontal split might occur maybe around here. Yeah, something like this. So, and you'd be right. So, I think I actually calculated either the Gini index or information gain with regards to this split. But this was perceived as, say, the best split for X. So, this is more homogeneous than splitting here, or splitting here, splitting here, right? And likewise, it's more homogeneous than if we're splitting on X, or excuse me, splitting on the vertical feature, where we're getting a big mix of blue and green. Yeah. Okay, so this is essentially a root node, and a root node is saying, okay, now we have branches that go to the left if the samples have a X value less than 6.2, or split to the right where the X value is greater than or equal to 6.2. And then we're doing the same thing on these subset or child nodes that we're creating from the splits. So now we're going to be just looking at this subset of data here. And if you look at it, so ignore everything left of this line, which feature might split this subset of data better? The X feature or the Y feature? Horizontal or vertical? It's a little bit more difficult in this case. So after running these calculations, we see that this is the best split of the data here, at least with respect to something like the information gain or Gini index. And likewise, we do the same again, where I think this time we're going to just be looking at the left side of the split. And when calculating, say, the Gini index or information gain, we get this split. And if I just stop making these splits right here, I already have a decision tree for not a great classifier, but a not too bad classifier on this data, right? So we're basically saying if X is less than or equal to, or if X is less than 6.2, we're going to guess it's blue to some degree of accuracy, so on and so forth, right? See how that works? So I have a quick, hopefully quick decision tree example I want to go over. Just kind of doing it by hand. Oh my goodness. this thing's being finicky today. But luckily, I'm switching over to the docking camera, so hopefully it's not causing too many problems. Okay, here we are. So, let's say we have the following data set. And I think I'm just going to draw it and ignore the actual values for now. But 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Where we have classes of X's and O's, where the O's are in the following positions, at 1, 4, 2, 4, 3, 5, and the X's are at 1.5, 3, 2.5, 3, and 4, 4.5, like this. Yeah. So we want to create a simple decision tree, say, from the set of data. The question we're going to ask ourselves is, all right, we're going to have to identify the points we wish to at least test the splits of the data. So I'm going to say possible split points. And one such method to do this is just to kind of write out every single possible value that X your samples can take and identify the middle between each of these in between each of these points. So these are all the values that our samples can take, and right in between 1 and 1.5 is 1.25, right? 1.75, 2.25, 2.75, and 3.5. And this just corresponds to where we can draw these lines, right? So 1.25 would be here, 3.5 would be here, right? Likewise, do the same with y. So we have 3, 4, 4.5, 5, and these kind of midpoints are 3.5, 4.25, and 4.75. All right. So let's go ahead and just quickly write down our kind of impurity measures we want to use in order to identify the best feature. So there's the Gini index, which we saw last time, which is just the following equation. It's the sum of the probabilities of choosing the different classes, given your sampling of samples. Well, then we have the entropy, so we have probability of choosing a sample of some class is the probability we're looking at, and in particular the information gain, which is essentially the entropy of the parent node, I should say the class entropy, and then you subtract the essentially the chosen conditional entropy, which is more or less the weighted average of entropy of child nodes. So let's go ahead and just go through how the algorithm would work. So assume you just start at the beginning. You're testing each one of these splits and you're calculating the information gain or entropy of the split to determine A, is the split good for this feature, and B, is this the best feature given our subset of data, right? So let's split on X at 1.25. We're just starting at the beginning, the first possible split that we can do, right? So our root node As of now, we're considering all the samples. So we're considering all of the O's and all of the X's. And we're making this rule here, or testing this rule, I should say, where what if we're splitting on X is less than 1.25? First things first, let's calculate the class entropy of the parent node. This is for the information gain calculation. And this is just, it's going to be probability of choosing O's, which is just 3 over 6, this is half. So we half log half plus the probability of choosing X's, right? Half log half, right. And this yields the following. So has an entropy of 1. This is the highest entropy you can have for two classes, right? It's a totally perfect split between the two different classes. But okay, so let's say we have this split here. What you do is you draw the child nodes out. We're on the left side. If we make a split here, we can see that there's only going to be one circle sample on the left side. But on the right side of the split, we'd have two circles and three X's, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah. So the circle's here, X is there. Okay, so then we need to calculate we're going to calculate both the Gini index and the entropy of each of these child nodes to determine kind of the value of this feature based on the split. So because this is a totally homogeneous child node subset of data, we know that the Gini index is 0. That means it's pure. Same thing with the entropy. But over here, it's slightly more involved because we have actual different classes of data here. So we have 1 minus the probability of choosing circles. What is the probability of choosing circles of the subset of data? Yeah, 40%. It's 2 over 5, right? You have 2 circles over a total of 5. 5 possibilities. So then we have 2/5 squared plus, and then of course the remaining possible selection is going to be 3/5 for selecting the X's. And I'm going to just kind of brush over the arithmetic here, and you get the following value here. The entropy here, similar kind of calculation. We already know the probability of choosing the O's. It's 2 over 5. We have 3 over 5 for choosing the X's. And this gets us an entropy of 0.97%. But to kind of evaluate the total value of this feature in this given split, we need to calculate the weighted average of both the Gini index and our entropies. So this weighted average Gini index is going to be 0 times 1/6, because 1/6 of the data is over here. That's just going to be 0. Plus 5 times 6 times the calculated Gini index over here. So that's times 0.48, and that gets you 0.4 in the end. So this is the kind of quantitative value we're giving this this feature in this split, at least for the Gini index. So then let's calculate the weighted average entropy. Similar sort of calculations. Entropy of 0 on this side times 1/6 plus 5/6 times this value over here, 0.97, and that gets you 0.81. And then if we want to calculate the information gain, this is going to be 1 minus 0.81. That equals 0.19. Okay. So this is just an evaluation of this feature in this particular split. And now imagine we go through every single different possible split, essentially doing the same thing. And we're essentially what we're doing is we're just looking for the feature in the split that gets us the highest information gain or Gini index, weighted average Gini index, I should say. So we repeat this a number of times over all the different features and possible splitting points. But now let's just look at the actual, say, best split. So we split on Y at 3.5. I'm going to try to draw it out a bit faster. So we have our initial data set that has not been partitioned yet. And say we're splitting it, Y is less than 3.5. Yeah. The entropy of the parent, the class entropy, is equal to 1, as before. So let's see what happens if we split at Y equals 3.5. So that's right here, right? And already we can tell that this is a better split than before. We have totally homogeneous case beneath the split, and an okay amount of homogeneity on the top of the split, right? So then we split our decision tree, or we partition our data based on this split. Left of, or beneath the split, I should say, we have two samples of class X. That gets you, these both have a Gini index value of 0 and entropy of 0, right? Totally homogeneous. And then we have calculating the Gini index over here, slightly more involved. This is going to be 1 minus, what is the probability of choosing O for this subset of data? 3/4, right? The other your 4 options are O's. And then likewise, probability of choosing X's is 1/4. And this gets you just a value of 3/8 in the end. Entropy, similar idea. We just write out the function here. And that gets you 0.81. Okay, so kind of getting to the punchline here, or the upshot. So the weighted average Gini index here is going to be 2/6 times 0, because 2/6 of the data is over here, has a Gini index of 0, plus 4/6, because 4 of the 6 data is over here, times its Gini index, 3 over 8, 0.25. We can see that this Gini index value is indeed lower than this one. So this is a pretty good guess that this splitting point will work well as our root node on the tree. And just kind of ending the calculations here for the entropy, same sort of idea where we're taking this weighted entropy. 4/6 times this calculated entropy, 0.54. So the information gain will be 1 minus 0.54, 0.46. And this is indeed higher than the information gain over here, thus again supporting this particular split being the best split for the root node of our tree. Any questions regarding decision trees, dealing with numeric values for the features, or anything else? Yes. You mean for every split? Yes. So, of course, there's different ways that you might kind of make this kind of binarization of your data. Like, for instance, maybe you don't split on every single possible splitting point. Maybe you only split on like quartiles or something like this. But this is one approach to doing it. No other questions? Okay. So, I think it's time for a break. We can come back here at 10:10. get back to it. What are the purpose of association rules? I think we covered that in the last lecture. Does anybody know what association rules are or how they can be used? This concept of market basket analysis. Basically, it's for identifying interesting relationships between items in a data set. So this is kind of a unsupervised learning approach, a very kind of basic one at that. The whole market basket analysis idea is that it identifies if a user buys item A, then they will also likely buy item B, right? So if someone is buying baby diapers, then they're likely to also buy baby formula along these lines, right? And you can represent this idea as a rule. So if item sets A, then likely B, right? So there are some metrics to measuring kind of how well these rules stack up, as well as just things that are necessary to calculate things like confidence. There's the concept of support. That is the frequency of item or item sets in the database. So it can be either represented as an integer or a percentage. So saying how many times does item sets of eggs and milk occur in this data set? That would be support. Then there's confidence, which is kind of a reliability rule. And you can kind of represent it as these different equations, but more or less in the end what it's asking is what is the number of transactions containing both the if-then-then item set over the total number of transactions just containing the if item set. Then there is another metric known as lift, kind of which illustrates the importance of a rule. And it shows the dependence between the antecedent, the if, and the consequent of the rule, the then. And there's kind of three values that are important with respect to lift. So a lift of 1 implies that x and y are independent of each other. A lift greater than 1 implies a degree of dependence between the item sets. A lift less than 1 implies that the items have a negative effect on each other and they're substitutable. So like, for instance, you may be able to substitute coffee for tea, for instance. We're going to go over some examples of association rules later, but any initial questions? There's a related algorithm that's kind of used before the association rules are made called the a priori algorithm. Does anybody know what it does? Yes. Associating different items. So yeah, what it does is exactly that. It finds frequent item sets in some database, for instance. And I wrote out a couple of like algorithms for calculating or running the a priori algorithm to calculate these popular item sets. But I think I'm going to go over the algorithm while going over this example here. So first thing that we're going to do here is we're going to have our data. For example here, what we have is we have 4 different samples, and each sample has some number of different items. It has sample 1 has item 1, 3, and 4. Sample 2 has item 2, 3, 5. Right. Then what we're going to do is we're count the times the items appear across all the different transactions, where we're setting this k being the number of items to 1. So what we're doing here is we're just counting how many times does item 1 appear in this entire database. So we see item 1 appears once, twice, So we write a support of 2. Item 2 occurs 1, 2, 3 times. So we write a support of 3. Likewise for item 3. But item 4 only occurs 1 time. And a parameter that you will set for the a priori algorithm is essentially this threshold of support. So here we're going to say the threshold of support is that item sets should have 2 or greater amount of support. And everything else that falls beneath that is removed from your current collection of items that you've counted up. So that's what we do here. So we remove item number 4, and we're just left with items 1, 2, 3, and 5. Then what we do is we then of the we increase this k, kind of the size of the item set that we're looking at. So first we're looking at item sets of just 1. Now we're looking at item sets containing 2 items. So of the items left, create a new list of all possible combinations of the remaining items where the combinations add up to 2 different items. So let's see here. In any element of these combinations whose subsets are not supported is not added. So what I mean by this is, for instance, we're generating all these different possible item sets, but you can see none of them contain 4, because we know that there's only 1 4 in our entire data set. So we know that kind of implicitly that these item sets that we generate of size 2, if one of them contains item 4 in it, it's not going to meet the threshold of support. So likewise, what we do is we count up the number of times these item sets occur. So we see item 1, 2, this occurs once in the data set. So we say give it a support of 1. Item 1, 3 occurs 2 times in the data set, so on and so forth. And more or less, we're repeating the same process as before. And we see that there are 2 item sets where k equals 2 that do not meet the threshold of support, so they're removed. And likewise, we then say move on to the next level of k, so k equals 3. So now we're looking at item sets of 3 that occur quite often. And the only one that is valid is actually 2, 3, and 5. And so the other possible combinations, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 5, 1, 3, 5, they're not considered since the subsets of them, 1, 2, and 1, 5, these items, only occur once, right? So basically what we say, okay, for these different levels of amount k, amounts of, say, items in these item sets, these are the most common or most popular item sets in our data set. So that would be the items here for items of size 1, here of item sets of size 2, here of item sets of size 3. So these generated frequent item sets can be used to create association rules. And in terms of use cases, there's research of applying them for things like intrusion detection, analysis of log files. And in particular, for me, in the research that I've been doing, identifying association between entities, between different documents. So for instance, what you can do is you can apply something called named entity recognition to, say, a document. And this automatically extracts things an algorithm assumes to be proper nouns from that document. And so essentially, from each document, you would then have a set of different names, right? And you can apply, say, the a priori algorithm or association rules on these sets of names and documents that you generate. So you can find, say, common groupings of names between different documents in kind of an automated fashion by doing this. So that's just one example of how people have been applying this in research. Any questions regarding the a priori algorithm or association rules? We'll go over an example of we'll go over some association rule examples later. Okay, so the last kind of symbolic learning technique we're going to discuss today, and we're kind of discussing this mostly due to historical importance. It's just a good algorithm to be aware of. But does anybody know how a simple naive Bayes classifier works? So, essentially, we're familiar with Bayes' theorem, right? So this is listed at the top. And this is the probability that something is of, say, class K, given some information about, say, a particular feature. And the rule is that you can generate this probability by using the following expression. Because sometimes this conditional probability is easier to calculate than this one, right? But, there's a overlap with the pictures and the text. There we go. But basically, for the sake of the classifier, the Bayes theorem kind of boils down into the following expression, where we're replacing this conditional probability here with this product of probabilities, and we're ignoring the denominator. But basically, the important thing is, for a particular sample, you're going over and you're calculating more or less a kind of probability that the sample belongs to each one of the different classes. And you choose the result or the class with the highest probability calculated in the end. And we're going to go over an example of this. So some properties of the naive Bayes classifier. It assumes all features are independent, and this is done for the sake of simplicity, so such that we can apply Bayes' theorem. This Bayes classifier, naive Bayes classifier, is super fast, which is another benefit of it. And just as a note, it's designed for categorical features, but it can be extended into applying to continuous features using something like binning that we talked about the last tutorial. So just as an example of how it works, basically, let us say that we have the following training data sets, and we have just this test sample, and we want to guess which class or predict which class the sample is. So to do this, what we want to do is essentially just run the calculations for this algorithm. So the first thing that we need to calculate is the probability that the samples take on, say, class 0 or class 1. So we can see in our data sets there are a total of 10 samples in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them. Or class 0, therefore the probability of choosing a sample of class 0 is 1/2, probability of choosing a sample of class 1 also 1/2, right? Then we need to calculate these conditional probabilities, say the probability that a sample has an attribute value of some given attribute value, given it is of this class. So for calculating, for instance, the probability that the sample has its first attribute as middle, and the given that the class is class 0, we can see here, here are the class 0 samples, right? And how many of them have an attribute being middle? Just one. So that's 1 out of 5, right? So we say, okay, this probability is equal to 1/5. And then you repeat this, more or less, but you're keeping the, let's say for now, assuming that the samples are of class 0, looking at feature 2, in the instances where attribute 2 is no. So there's one case here. So 1 out of 5 again. So that's 1 out of 5. And then likewise, you do the same thing, calculating the conditional probability if the feature, the third attribute is red and the class is 0. And you're doing the same calculations again, but now under the assumption that the conditional probability that it is of class 1. So for example, the probability that feature 2 is no and of class 1, given that it is class 1, would be, this is feature 2 is no. Here we go. So class 1 is this one, this one, this one has feature no, this one has feature no, this one has feature no. So that's 3 out of 5, right? So I'm not going to go over every single conditional probability here, but here that I'm just showing that we've calculated all the necessary probabilities to make these calculations. So we're asking the question, is the sample in class 0? So we're taking essentially all these probabilities here and just multiplying them together and getting some final product with a quantitative value of 0.008. And then there's the question, is this of class 1? And here what we're doing is we're multiplying essentially all of these values here, considering class 1, and getting a product at the end. And here we have the value is higher than the assumption if it is in class 0. So because we're higher, because it is higher, we're assuming that the predicted class is class 1 as opposed to class 0. So basically you're just using the statistics of your training data set table and applying a portion of Bayes' theorem and essentially choosing the class which yields you the highest probabilistic value. Yeah? Any questions regarding naive Bayes? So you can see why I'd be fast, because there's like, the learning is, it's kind of already there. It's your data set. You're just getting some statistics from it, really. Yes. So there is a kind of heuristic, kind of a rule of thumb in which you make a number of calculations, but you choose the one which gives you, say, the best value. But I don't know if there's too many similarities beyond that regarding the decision tree and naive Bayes. As you saw in the example with the decision tree, there's a lot more work in finding, say, these best values. But if you have any further questions, feel free to ask. Any others? Just checking online. Okay. So that's naive Bayes. Okay, now on to kind of these more statistical methods. K-nearest neighbor classifier. So I think you've heard of this by now and saw it in the last lecture. Why is it called the lazy classifier? Maybe more generally, does anybody know how the K-nearest neighbor's algorithm works? And then we have the sub-question later about circumventing this dominant class problem, but we'll get to that in a little bit. All right, K-nearest neighbors, this lazy learning method. Basically, the whole idea is, say, in this example here, you have a new sample where you don't know its class. And to do the classification, you basically say, okay, I'm going to set K equal to, 3. some hyperparameter value that you give it, and you're saying this green sample here is the class of its k nearest neighbors. That's literally it. So if k equals 3, in this case, is this sample going to be a triangle or a square as a class? I know they're different shapes in reality, but like, does it belong to the triangle classes or the square classes? I mean, we can see that these three are its three nearest neighbors, correct? This. The majority of these are triangles, right? So using k nearest neighbors method, you would say this is also a triangle. Yeah, it's also lazy because there's no kind of explicit objective optimization process that we're following. So lazy, this k nearest neighbors method has a couple of different hyperparameters you can set. There's k, that being the number of neighbors you're saying should be closest to your samples to classify it. But also there's the distance metric. So the typical one we think of is the Euclidean one, just like the normal distance metric. But there's other kinds of distance metrics you can use, such as the Manhattan distance metric, which is essentially like, they call it the city block distance metric. So rather than, if you're working on a grid, rather going straight from point A to point B, you have to travel up at least by one for every time you go up or to the side. That's the city block name. All right, so, but what if k equals 5 for this sample? We're considering its 5 closest neighbors. So then this questionable sample in the middle, we would then predict that it is a square, right? So that you can see there. Okay, so there's this dominant class problem that especially affects something like k-nearest neighbors. Clearly, if you have larger values of k, unseen samples are more likely to be classified as the dominant class. So if you have an imbalanced data set, and I don't know, say there's, 30 samples that are squares and only 10 samples that are triangles, and you have a k, equal to 15 to 20 or something like this, you can see why it would then be that the sample would be automatically more or less classified as the dominant class, right? So the solution is to apply kind of a weighting scheme, a weighting function to each of the points, which is based on the inverse of the distance from the sample to these nearest neighbors. So this function is the weight of the neighbors. So, for example, for 1 over d, samples that are closer have much, much more weight. So let's do a quick little example on the screen here. So let's say this is the distance between the sample and this circle is 1. So the distance between here and here is like 0.5. Distance between here and here is, 0.2, the distance between here and here is, let's call it 0.8, and the distance between here and here is 1.5, and for simplicity, I'm just going to say this is a distance is 1.5. So there's my kind of crappy writing, as you can see there. And then we can calculate kind of the weights of each sample here. So that would be 1 over 0.2. That's going to be 5. This is going to be 1 over 0.5. That's going to be 2. And 1 over 0.8. And 1 over 1.5. Just going to be 2/3. So if we're considering k equals 3, we still have these three nearest neighbors here, but the total weight of the triangles is going to be, it's going to be 1 over 0.2 is 5, plus 1 over 0.5 is 2. So the total weight of the triangle is a 7. And the total weight of the squares here is 1.25, 1 over 8. So here for k equals 3, like before, still we're saying that the sample is a triangle. But if we say k equals 5, then we're also considering these neighbors as well, and we're adding their weights to kind of the sum of the weights of the squares. So this is 2/3 plus 2/3. That is 1 1/3 plus 1.25, more or less close to 2.5. So even when we're saying k equals 5, the total weight of the squares is only 2.5, roughly speaking, and the weight of the triangles is 0.7. So the classification of the sample using this weighting scheme would then still say, okay, this sample's probably a triangle, right? Any questions regarding k nearest neighbors, the weighting scheme? Okie doke. So this is another kind of quick one that I've added. We're not going to go into the details of it. But I think it's important to at least be aware of it for statistical learning. What is logistic regression? And is logistic regression actually doing regression or classification? Or both? Let me just take off my pen. All right, there we go. So essentially what logistic regression is, we're fitting this sigmoid function here onto data that can only take binary classes. And by doing this, we can create a classification model that also gives you a level of confidence to our classification. So, I mean, in this case, we're just looking at, say, one feature, and then these samples down here of class 0 and these samples up here are class 1, and you're trying to fit this curve as tight as possible onto this data. So, say you have a new sample, then obviously, you don't know whether it is class 1 or class 0. You just have the value of its features. And this, in here, we just have the feature of the hours of study, for instance. So, say that you study for 2.5 hours, and then according to the model that we have, which we fit on this training data, it would say, okay, then you're going to have more or less a confidence interval of say 50%. So it's not a very good indication one way or the other whether or not this sample will belong to class 1 or class 0. Obviously, the more, say, hours you study, the more confident you are that your answer is going to be of class 1. The less hours you study, the more confident then that you are going to be of class 0. So that's another reason why they use the sigmoid function, because it takes values just between 0 and 1 such that you can get this kind of confidence output. And just in terms of the equation here, W is referring to the model's weights, which is being updated through the training and learning process, and the vector X. So these are your features. So that's logistic regression in a nutshell. Any quick questions regarding logistic regression? So even though it has regression in the name, it's the regression is occurring by fitting this sigmoid function onto the data, but then it's used as a classification model. Yeah? Any questions? And if you're kind of interested in more details regarding logistic regression and kind of more or less how it came about and some kind of mathematical reasoning behind it, there's some nice lecture notes from Stanford discussing this. But I just wanted to give you at least a first impression of what logistic regression is. Okay, now on to some of the fun stuff. An artificial neural network. What is that? Kind of any definition will do. What is like the motivation behind it, or what are the actual properties of these networks? Well, I'll tell you. So I'm not going to get into the details of the motivation behind it, but more or less there are these computational models inspired by actual biological neural networks from the brain. And the main purpose is to essentially have something to approximate just like any given function, more or less, given some training data. And they're very powerful in doing that, especially the more advanced you go on. And furthermore, it's the basis of this machine learning subcategory of deep learning, which is actually, there's quite a lot to that as well. So we're going to go over kind of like the basics of artificial neural networks and not get into, at least theoretically, into details like things like convolutional neural networks or transformers and stuff like that. Right, and different network architectures and methods of training allow them to excel very well in different tasks. So, as I was mentioning, convolutional neural networks are very good at image classification. Things like transformer models are very good for developing language models, for instance. But kind of, let's talk a little bit more concretely. What are neural networks? We're going to discuss it with respect to by looking at kind of the most basic component of a neural network called a perceptron. But basically, all artificial neural networks have the following properties. You have your input layer, where each input neuron represents, say, a feature, and takes in a value of that feature for the given sample. So for instance here, this here is your input layer, where assume you only have four features being used as input. This could be for the iris data set. This could be the value of sepal width, sepal length, petal width, petal length, for instance. Now, in between each neuron, connecting each neuron, there's a weight. So, yeah, each connection from a neuron to another neuron has a weight associated with it. And it's the learning process that updates these weights. And we've seen updating some weights before in linear regression, in logistic regression, and it's actually kind of similar for neural networks as well. So as you can see here, there's some sort of weight being applied to each of the connections between the input neurons and, in this case, our output neuron. And once you get kind of beyond the input layer, so either, say, the output layer or other layers, the neurons have something called an activation function inside of it. And more or less, this is a function that defines the output of the node, given a set of inputs. And kind of thinking at it in terms of the biological sense, the function determines how much of the node fires, or what is the threshold for the node to fire given the input. So basically, you can see here, you will have the inputs to the neuron, which is essentially just a sum of each of your values here times their weights. And this sum is being input into the activation function. And right now, let's just say the activation function is a vague function f. I can write it out if it lets me. So f just assume and assume right now, let's just say we're letting f be right now, let's just say let f be just a linear function. So we're going to have x1 times w1 plus x2 times w2, so on and so forth. And more or less, this is going to be the input to your function. If we're working with a linear function as an activation function, this is also going to be your output. So why do we have these activation functions? Essentially, what they do is they can introduce nonlinearity into the network, which is necessary if you want to, say, do classification with nonlinear boundaries, for instance. And it allows you to solve non-trivial problems. As you can see, the input to these functions is is essentially a combination of, it's a linear combination of items. Right. So the input to each of these neurons of the activation functions is the sum of all the weights times the previous neuron outputs plus something called the bias. So the bias can be added to the weighted sum of inputs, acting as a constant for the activation function. And more or less, and this is represented by this here, typically speaking, it's represented as just say value 1, where the connecting weight is given the notation W0, and this W0 is updated just like all the other weights. So the kind of way to think about it is the activation function the bias is what allows the activation function to be shifted, say, left or right, which is essentially changing the activation threshold. So what is required as input to fire that neuron, so to speak. So when you're doing the learning, what is being updated are all of these weights, all the W's. So here are some more examples of activation functions. A quite popular one is the sigmoid function. And this is what we saw in the logistic regression as well. Taking the values between 0 and 1, it's a continuous function. And more or less, if we, say, change the bias, we say plus 1 to our bias, I think we shift the function to the left. And if we do minus 1, we shift the function to the right. Then there's other things like the tan function. And then there's these kind of non-continuous functions, sigma function, step function. And likewise, by changing the bias, you change where this kind of splitting point between, say, negative 1 and positive 1 occurs, right? A popular activation function is also the ReLU function. So I thought I'd mention it as well. Basically, for some given inputs, if the sum of the input plus the bias or whatever is greater than 0, then the function is activated. So just defining this single layer perceptron, what we looked at before, this here. A single layer perceptron has an input layer and an output layer of neurons and can solve very simple, that is linearly separable, problems. But in order to solve more complex and nonlinear problems, you actually have to use hidden layers of neurons. So What is a hidden layer? Essentially, a hidden layer are the layers that occur between your input layer and your output layer. Those are hidden layers. But the neurons behave just like the neurons we were describing before. They have activation functions, and they take in the input from the previous layer, including the bias as well. So, for example, for approximating the XOR function requires at least one hidden layer. So, for example here, the first image on the left side is showing a single layer perceptron and its linear classifications of some different problems. So we can do linear classification of the OR function. So C, we're splitting between the positive and negative values here in a linear way. Likewise for the AND function. But you can't split in a linear fashion the XOR function, not with a single layer perceptron. So by having hidden layers and, say, nonlinear activation functions, you can solve the XOR problem, where essentially, rather than having these, say, individual linear borders between the samples, you can have essentially regions of classification. So on the right is only possible once we add hidden layers to our neural network. Here we can see we are classifying the samples of class 1 in the green and the samples of class 0 on the outside. So then what is deep learning? Generally, this means lots and lots of hidden layers. It performs very, very well, but generally it requires a ton of training data, like much more than I think we are usually accustomed to seeing in this class. So networks with only a few hidden layers are at times referred to as shallow, so to speak. So if you have a network that only has two hidden layers, I wouldn't really call that deep learning. Then let's get into some concepts regarding artificial neural networks. So an important concept is called forward propagation. Essentially, we are evaluating what the artificial neural network calculates based on its inputs and its given weights and its biases. And this is all fed through the neural network from the input layer all the way to the output layer to some, if you're using a single neuron, it would be a single output. If you're using more than one output neuron, it would be multiple outputs. So let's go over kind of an example of this. So here we have a simple little neural network where we have an input layer here, hidden layer here, and an output layer here. And let's assume that the input is from the iris data set, so you can imagine this value here referring to the sepal length, sepal width, petal length, petal width, right? So we're using this as input in our input layer. And this is a fully connected neural network, so the input layer has connections to each one of the nodes in the hidden layer. And each neuron in the hidden and output layer is using this sigmoid function as an activation function. Yeah? So if we want to see or calculate what is the output of this neuron here, what we're doing is we're providing some input to this neuron, that being this first input value times its weight. Right? See that? Second input value times its weight. Third input value times its weight. Fourth input value times its weight. And lastly, bias. Right? So we see how this is the input to this neuron, at the very least. Right? Does that make sense? So the input to the neuron is essentially just the input to this particular function, the sigmoid function here. So that's what we've done so far. And then we calculate this value, and this is what gets us the output of this neuron. So if you run this calculation here, you get 0.999 being the output of this neuron. And right now, I've just randomly initialized these weight values for this neural network. Likewise, we can calculate the output of this function here in the same manner, right? So, for instance, as the input to this hidden neuron here, we'll have 2.3 times its weight connecting to this neuron, right? Times negative 0.4. The input here times its weight, negative 1. You see how it works, right? In terms of input. Again, we're using the same activation function here. And ultimately, we're getting this value calculated as output from this neuron. Yeah? And then we can try to calculate the actual output of our output layer. In this case, it's just a single neuron. And we're more or less doing the same thing. But now we're just operating from the hidden layer to the output layer, right? So as input to this neuron, we have 0.99 times its weight. And then we have 0.237 times its weight. And we add the bias, in which case we can calculate the activation function to get this output of 0.0453. And just kind of in terms of interpreting it, you will, in your data set, for example, in the homework, you will have one class be class 0 and one class be class 1. So after you train your model and update your weights, the outputs of this function, given any sample, ideally should be towards class 1 or towards 1 or towards 0. So basically, if you're nearer to 1, you're class 1. If you're nearer to 0, you're class 0. Any questions regarding this? Do we understand how this forward propagation works, at the very least? Yeah? Right, so forward propagation is the easy part. There are different learning rules for training and updating your neural networks. But basically what they do, and this is very much like we've seen in the past for optimizing these algorithms, is that there's some error information. That is the difference between the output that you have now and your desired output, like your target class, is fed back into the system, which helps make adjustments to the parameters of the neural network, that being the weights, in a systematic fashion using some sort of learning rule. So typically things that are related to gradient descent. Quite often, this error information and this objective function we're trying to optimize is related to something like the mean squared error that we've seen in the past. So a very popular algorithm for doing this is called backpropagation, where basically you input all your training data and the error of your output versus the expected output guides the training of your weights. And essentially, this is done in a similar fashion to gradient descent. And you do this for many iterations until you have a closely optimized solution. However, that's for the next tutorial. We're not going to get into it now, but just as a kind of a taster of things to come. So that's kind of the theoretical aspects of the tutorial today. So we're 100% clear on how at least neurons, activation functions, weights, and biases, and forward propagation works. I mean, if you have more questions, just speak up. Let's go ahead and take a 10-minute break, and we'll be back at 11:10. Okay. Yeah, so now on to some of the practical examples. And at least for this one, I think I'm going to fly through it quite quickly. And again, you can also test it for yourself at home. But more or less what we're asking is, given this data set, apply k-nearest neighbors on it to get the classifications of these samples using different values of k, different number of nearest neighbors. So considering the three nearest neighbors versus the five nearest neighbors, right? So just as kind of a spoiling result and a bit of a crappy drawing, you can see the results here, where the blue points are the samples from our training data set, where green is associated with, let's see here, that's going to be, I should verify this, 1, 2, this class 1, and then, oh, I should verify this actually. No, that looks right, actually. Okay. Class 1 is green, and class 2 is red. And just for illustration's purposes, you can see that when we change the value of k to be higher, we get a different prediction for the classes. So at first, looking at our test sample 1, 2, our three nearest neighbors are right here. We can see, okay, that's clearly 2 from the green class, so that's class 1. However, if you extend that to k equals 5, then these are the 5 nearest neighbors, where we can see that the red class is dominant. So that's class 2. And the same thing happens with this point right here. Whereas this point, even when you increase the value k from 3 to 5, it remains the same class. So just some properties regarding k nearest neighbors. There's a reason why we don't choose even amounts of k, just so we avoid getting into ties between, say, one class being equal to another class. But if you do have any tie breaks, this can be dealt with by reducing k by 1 until some definite answer is found. There's times also where you may have, say, an equal distance between multiple points where you don't have a definite, is this class occurring more often than this class given some set of neighbors? And likewise, you can try to solve it in a similar manner by reducing k by 1. And there also exists a problem of selecting the optimal number of neighbors k, right? So typically speaking, if you have some very low amount of neighbors for k-nearest neighbors, you're going to have a high amount of error for your classification accuracy. Likewise, if you have too many neighbors, again, you are typically expecting a high amount of error. So there's a kind of a sweet spot in the middle. And I've included some Python code to show how to do this very simply. You may take note of this because you're supposed to use k-nearest neighbors in your homework, and you can use a library for it too. And here you can see you can change the distance metric, whether it be Euclidean or Manhattan or what else. Yes. I don't think there's much to go over with that problem. It's pretty straightforward. Just a quick example showing how association rules work, or at least the assessment of them, by looking at things like these confidence metrics or these support metrics. So we have our different transactions where basically a 1 being there means that the item is present, 0 being there means the item is not present. And we're wondering about the confidence of the following statement. If a customer buys a cola, a fish soup, and some butter, will they also buy bread? Is more or less what we're asking. So, to evaluate this, we break our kind of if-then statement into its two components, this cola, fish soup, and butter components and bread component. And we ask, what is the confidence of this? And this is just this following equation where we just plug in some numbers, right? So what is the support of X and Y? That is, how often does all these items occur in a single purchase? Well, that occurs just once here. There's no other item set with all these items in it. Then how often does just the beginning of the if statement occur? Item sets with just cola, fish soup, and butter. So here we can say, okay, just, there's just a supportive one there as well. So that's 1/7/1/7. It's a 100% confidence. I mean, it's good, but this also assumes a minimum support of one. So in a realistic case, this table would likely be much larger, and we would require the minimum support to be higher as well. So this is just for illustrative purposes of how to calculate things like confidence. And likewise, we can also calculate the support as well, which got a value above one. So there's apparent dependence between the item sets. So we're going to actually now use Weka to kind of look at a larger data set, this car evaluation data set. And what it will do for us by applying these two different algorithms is create, say, the best rules it identifies from the given data set. And this is categorical data. So we're kind of asking, what are the best 10 rules that we can extract from this data set? And what is the confidence level of these rules? So if you look here, this is the data set we're working with. It's about buying cars. And there's some features with them. So the features being like how expensive it is, very high, for instance, like how much, I think this is how much maintenance it needs, possibly, how many doors it has, how many people it can fit, how big is the lug, the boots, the trunk, so small, large, medium, etc., and how safe the car is perceived to be. And then the actual class, which goes from unacceptable, acceptable, good, and very good, right? So when we input this into Weka, which I've already done here, we can see that we have these different features and the different classes. And we can see immediately that there are many unacceptable cars, a good handful of acceptable cars, some very good cars, and some good cars. So if you go to Associate, the Associate tab, which we have not really gone to yet, and we're just going to choose Predictive a priori and let it run on the data set. And just as a quick note, Predictive a priori algorithm, it's similar to the a priori algorithm, which is finding these common item sets, except that a priori has an increasing support threshold. So the original a priori algorithm we looked at, we had some just defined support thresholds saying, like, okay, we need at least two item sets to be here all the way through the algorithm. Predictive a priori iterates this number as you go on. So it takes a little bit longer. So it should be done now. So here are the best rules that were found and some given accuracy measure as well. So, for instance, the best rules being if the car only fits two persons and it has a small trunk, then the car is likely deemed unacceptable, which makes sense from a personal use case. Even if there are two persons, if it's two people and the trunk is medium size, it's unacceptable. You see there's a bit of a pattern here. With respect to if there are two persons, this car is being deemed as unacceptable. Yeah. But even other rules, such as if the car fits four people, but the safety is low, the car is deemed unacceptable. So you can see here, the safety being low is a common sort of feature in an unacceptable car. So that's just an example of some generated rules from this given data set. You can also run the a priori algorithm, which generates some similar rules, but it's much faster. And here it's generating the 10 best rules, and you're getting similar sort of rules. For instance, if the car only has two people, the car is unacceptable. If the safety is low, the car is unacceptable. Some similar findings that we saw before. So that's an application of kind of this association rule mining. Any questions regarding just association rules or any of the rules generated? And there you can see the numbers give the supports of how often these item sets pop up. Okay, this is last one, and again, it's another k-nearest neighbors example, and I'm not going to go over it in depth. I just want to show that you can use different distances for the distance metrics in k-nearest neighbors, and by using different distance metrics, you get different results. So here we're asking you to calculate to kind of make predictions for these classes using k-nearest neighbors, using these values of k, number of neighbors, and these distance metrics. So Euclidean distance, Manhattan distance, and we're saying Chebyshev distance. And just to show you what these are, let's see here. Pen. Okay. For instance, Euclidean distance between this point and this point, straight line, right? It's what we know. Manhattan distance between this point and this point would be 1, 2, 3, 4 as a city block distance, right? It's a bit messy, but then the Chebyshev distance, essentially what you can think of it is like it's chessboard distance, like if you're like a queen. So that means that if you move a diagonal between this part of the grid and this part of the grid, this covers a distance of 1. So 1, 2, 3. So Chebyshev distance is 3. Manhattan distance is 4. And Euclidean distance is, the length of this line. Yeah? Just to give you an idea. And I mention this because it's also included in your homework. You should implement these different distances. So, as you can see here, these are for the different values of k, and you can see there's either class 1 or class 2 as a classification, and the different distance metrics have different classifications. This changes as you increase k, as one would expect, and so on and so forth. So if you'd like to test that out for yourself, feel free to do so. But this is all I have for you today. If there's any questions, either ask them now or send me an email. And just be sure to get started on your homework. So, thanks for listening.